Hello, I'm Bob Steele. This is number 2191, the Sapphire Poem with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0191. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, a return visit from Dennis Palumbo, author of the new Daniel Rinaldi mystery, Night Terror. It's another thriller featuring Pittsburgh therapist Daniel Rinaldi.
He's brought in by the FBI to treat one of their retired serial killer profilers. I mean, this is a guy who has spent 20 years inside the heads of the worst serial killers in the country. And now he has night terrors, wakes up screaming. Not only that, but apparently he's on a hit list. There's an unknown shooter out there who's going around assassinating anyone who had to do with putting the last serial killer my FBI profiler put into prison.
Life coach Janice Bastani is concerned about people who live through their gadgets. There are a couple of signs that you might be too connected.
One of them is, do you sleep within arm's reach of your technology at night? If that's true, then perhaps you might want to not have your technology in the same room that you sleep in. It needs to be far enough away so that you don't hear the vibration or hear the alert that goes off. The other thing is, if your bed is your communication hub, you have a problem, a real problem.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabbie, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. He shares an interesting study on public urination.
What came out this past week was a study, and, you know, they probably spent millions and millions of dollars on it because that's what politicians do. And guess what? They found out that in those neighborhoods where a lot of liquids are drunk, those are those neighborhoods in which you're more apt to have somebody pee. Now, isn't that a fantastic scientific thing, which, as I said, probably cost $100 million to figure it out?
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0191, was Bob Steele, who is an avid fan and listener and supporter of the Stuff File program. And I thank you very, very much, Bob, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. I also thank you very much for your support and your continued listenership to this program. Hope you'll keep tuning in and tell all your friends about it as well. Thank you very much, Bob. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, British design engineer Jess Eaton introduced her second high fashion collection in December at London's White Gallery, this time consisting of supposedly elegant bridal wear made in part with roadkill, cat and alpaca fur, seagull wings, and human bones. Ooh. Wow, she sounds like she could be a guest star on CBS's Criminal Minds. It also sounds like she has some issues concerning marriage. Yeah. Some third worlders eat dirt because they are mentally ill or have no meaningful food. However, diners at Tokyo's upscale Nikita Par eatery eat it because it is a trendy dish prepared by prominent chef Toshio Tanabe. Among his courses are soil soup, served with a flake of dirty truffle, soil sorbet, and the soil surprise, a dirt-covered potato ball. Spoiler alert, it has a truffle center. Tanabe lightly pre-cooks his dirt and runs it through a sieve to eliminate the crunchiness. Gee, do you think at some point Tanabe got angry with someone and yelled, "Eat my dirt," and a light bulb went off over his head? And this is a trendy upscale restaurant that makes you eat dirt. Clearly, this is a place for people with more dollars than cents. Okay, before I start this next story, I have to confess I am a picky eater. Dirt aside, too, I don't eat that as well. But still, I've never heard of picky crooks. Arlington County, Virginia police reported in February that a resident of Carlin Springs Road told officers that someone entered her home and stole chicken from her simmering crock pot, but only the chicken, leaving the vegetables as they were. The report noted that they had no suspects. By the way, I've never been to Virginia myself, so trust me, I have an alibi. Okay, among the lingering costs of U.S. wars are disability payments and compensation to veterans' families, which can continue decades after hostilities end. An Associated Press analysis of federal payment records released in March even found two current recipients of Civil War benefits. Yes, you heard me right, Civil War benefits. I'll get back to that later. Vietnam War payments are still about $22 billion a year. World War II, $5 billion. World War I, $20 million. And the 1898 Spanish-American War, about $1,700 a year. Okay, so you're asking yourself, how is the U.S. government still paying disability payments as Civil War benefits? Well, two elderly children of Civil War veterans in North Carolina and Tennessee receive money even though they were born in the 1920s and 30s. The two recipients in question were fathered by Civil War veterans who themselves were in their 70s and 80s, not an uncommon occurrence, especially in the veterans community. Now, those two offspring I just mentioned receive $876 a year in benefits. Such survivor payments usually end by the time children turn 18, but those born with disabilities, rendering them incapable of caring for themselves, are covered for life. So you see, war is hell and extremely costly. And that's if you win. Finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, undocumented immigrant Jose Munoz, age 25, believed himself an ideal candidate for President Obama's 2012 Safe Harbor Initiative for illegal entry children, in that he was brought to the United States by his undocumented parents before the age of 16, had no criminal record, and had graduated from high school with honors even. Since then, however, he had remained at home in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, assisting his family, doing odd jobs, and admittedly, just playing video games and vegging. Living in the shadows, he found it almost impossible to prove the final legal criterion, that he has lived continuously in the U.S. since graduating, using government records, payroll sheets, utility bills, etc., etc., etc. After initial failures to convince immigration officials, Munoz's lawyer succeeded by submitting his Xbox Live records documenting that his computer's Wisconsin location had been accessing video games day after day for years. Yes. You know, somewhere out there is an American hearing this story who will complain about how an undocumented immigrant can afford an Xbox and the ongoing online subscription fees that come with it. And of course, they will be completely missing the point. So, let's just move on. And as a matter of fact, let's just get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Dennis Palumbo was one of my favorite authors. In addition to being a writer, he is also a licensed psychotherapist and former Hollywood screenwriter. He has now written his third crime novel featuring therapist Daniel Rinaldi. The first two were Mirror Image and Fever Dream, both phenomenal reads, by the way. The latest is called Night Terrors, and Dennis joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Great. Nice to have you back on the program again.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
I know this book is coming out. It's now in pre-release. It's coming out in May. I'm so looking forward to it because I love the first two.
Well, thank you so much. Personally, I think it's the best of the three. It's the third adventure for Daniel Rinaldi, and it comes out on May 7th, and the publisher is Poisoned Pen Press.
Now, tell us about the title and the story, Night Terrors.
Well, as many of your listeners may know, night terrors is actually a diagnosis. It's a sleep disorder. Primarily, it had been diagnosed in children. It was a pediatric diagnosis for kids who would, like, wake up screaming and terrified with their hearts beating. But in the last 15, 20 years, there's been a rise in diagnosing night terrors in adults. And what makes night terrors so particularly interesting is that you don't remember what terrified you. It's not like a nightmare where you have a dream image. Funnily enough, night terrors take place in the fourth stage of the sleep cycle instead of in REM sleep, so you don't remember it. But you wake up screaming, your heart's palpitating, you're sweating, your adrenaline's pumping. Sometimes people sleepwalk. And while there's actually no known understanding of what causes night terrors, many social psychologists believe that life has become so difficult and uncertain that adults are suppressing a lot of their anxiety during the day. You know, there's terrorism and earthquakes and tsunamis and the economy. You know, there's so much uncertainty and fear that adults have to suppress in their daily life, you know, to pay their bills and go to work. And it seems to be now emerging in their sleep in night terrors. And so in the novel Night Terrors, my hero, Daniel Rinaldi, who's a psychologist who consults with the Pittsburgh police, is brought in by the FBI to treat one of their retired serial killer profilers. I mean, this is a guy who has spent 20 years inside the heads of the worst serial killers in the country, and now he has night terrors, wakes up screaming. And not only that, but he's on, apparently he's on a hit list. There's an unknown shooter out there who's going around assassinating anyone who had to do with putting the last serial killer my FBI profiler put into prison, anyone who had anything to do with putting that guy into prison. You know, and so it's as though John Wayne Gacy or Ted Bundy had a fan out there somewhere who was mad at all the people who put that person behind bars. And so it's a race against time to keep this guy alive before the shooter gets to him. And for people who've read the first two books, you know, the same cast of characters inhabit night terrors as inhabited Mirror Image and Fever Dream. And, of course, as always, it's against the backdrop of modern-day Pittsburgh, which is a city in transition.
Now, as I say, you're in L.A., you're in California, but you originally are from Pittsburgh.
Right. I was born and raised in Pittsburgh. I went to the University of Pittsburgh, and funnily enough, you know, I'm an Italian-American who grew up in Pittsburgh with a beard and glasses, and so is Daniel Rinaldi, strangely enough. But I get to use a lot of autobiographical material in writing my novels, and it's a lot of fun.
Well, with the success of the first two books, have you been hearing from people in Pittsburgh or the city fathers who appreciate where your stories take place?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've gotten a lot of coverage in the local media in Pittsburgh, and I'm going back, you know, on May 18th, I'm doing the book launch, actually, for the third book, for the third time, at the Mystery Lovers Bookshop, which is a wonderful independent mystery bookstore in Pittsburgh. And, you know, the funny thing is, as anyone who's ever written material that takes place in a real city or town will tell you, you also get emails and letters and phone calls when you get anything wrong. If you get the street wrong, or if you have, you know, your hero going down the street that's a one-way street going the wrong way, or if you get the name of a bridge wrong, you really hear from people, particularly native Pittsburghers, so it's kind of fun.
Now, in putting a story like this together, and again, I mentioned you're a writer and a psychotherapist, you the book is called Night Terrors. Obviously, it deals with a particular type of affliction that some people have. What comes first for you? Do you write a story and then figure what's the cause of that story, or do you have a cause and write a story around it?
Well, it's different for every book. In this case, I had just been reading about the rise in diagnosis in night terrors in adults, you know, and the fact that it might be because, you know, we walk around suppressing so much material during the day. And I thought, man, I guess if I were a serial killer profiler for the FBI, I'd have a lot of stuff I was suppressing all day long. And that's where I got the idea. I just thought, who would be the most likely adult candidate to wake up screaming every night? And I thought, an FBI profiler. So that's where that came from. And then, you know, I always have to figure out, as any novelist who has a series character, you have to sort of figure out a way to get your series character involved in that situation. Well, if you recall, in Fever Dream, one of the people working on the bank robbery investigation was an FBI agent. So I bring him back in Night Terrors and have him approach my hero, Daniel Rinaldi, and say, well, I just heard from the director that we need you to help our guy here.
And
that's how the story starts.
How much research do you go into? For instance, did you talk to the FBI? Do you talk to profilers as you try to put these characters together for this latest book, Night Terrors?
Well, I didn't talk to profilers, but I researched the heck out of them. In fact, there's a lot of information about not only how serial killers think and operate and our understanding of it, but also on whatever treatment modalities are being experimented with for the night terrors diagnosis. I think one of the things that gives my books, at least I hear from people, a tremendous relevancy and sense of reality is that I know what I'm talking about. If you recall from Mirror Image, my lead character's best friend is a paranoid schizophrenic, and he's actually based on a patient I worked with at a psychiatric hospital where I worked for many years with schizophrenics. And in Fever Dream, the second novel, it's about the traumatic response to being in a hostage in a bank robbery. So the reader learns a lot about how trauma is dealt with, how panic attacks are dealt with. So I try to give that verisimilitude to all of my novels, at the same time making them entertaining, fast-moving, lots of twists and turns. I'm proud of Night Terrors in particular because it's so suspenseful. Publishers Weekly called it riveting.
Wow. Now, third novel. So has Daniel Rinaldi, as you write him, kind of become an old friend? Are you more comfortable with Daniel as you continue to write this character?
Oh, absolutely. That's the thing that was so striking is I think by this third novel, I have a great familiarity with him. I learn more about him every time I write it. I always thought I knew who he was when I wrote the first novel. But as the second and the third one have unfolded, I've learned other things about him that I didn't know. And that makes it exciting and interesting for me. And I think for the reader, also that my stories don't stay static. In other words, the people that populate my novels, you know, his friends, his colleagues, their lives go through changes too. People get married, they get divorced, you know, they move away, they come to town, they get different jobs, just like people do in real life, just like your friends and colleagues do in real life. Because I feel like, an obligation to my readers who've come, you know, become kind of attached to some of these secondary characters, I feel like I have an obligation to provide a narrative for these people's lives as they move forward. And so does Daniel.
Here's my greedy question, because I always get greedy. The new one is coming out. You can pre-order it right now, which I will do. But are you working on a fourth?
Yes, I am. I've just started formulating it in my head. I don't plan very much ahead. The writer E.L. Doctorow once said that about writing. He said it's sort of like driving home at night on a winding road. Your headlights only show you 10 feet ahead, but sooner or later you get home. And that's kind of how I write these things. People can't believe it, but I usually start with like a notion or an idea or an image in my mind and go from there. I often don't know who the victim is, and I rarely know who the killer is going to be till about halfway through the book. Then I have to go back and seed in a bunch of clues to give the reader a chance to figure it out.
Do you ever, since you've, again, written three books now, as you write Daniel's stories, do you ever say, you ever write something and say, I can't use that now, but it shows up in the second or third book?
Oh, all the time. Actually, there's a real interesting dramatic sequence in the middle of Fever Dream that is part of an unfinished novel that I was working on years and years ago. That I always liked. I always liked that segment. And so I reworked it so that it would fit in with the story in Fever Dream. You know, I'm a very frugal writer. Nothing ever goes to waste.
Well, as I said at the beginning, I've read the first two. I really enjoyed them. They're both phenomenal reads. Looking forward to this new one. It's called Night Terrors, written by Dennis Palumbo. And Dennis, I thank you once again for being on the program.
Oh, my pleasure. And for any of your listeners who want to learn about me or my work, they can always go to my website, www.dennispalumbo.com.
Thank you very much, Dennis.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Dennis Palumbo, author of Night Terrors. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0191, and you'll find links to Dennis's site, plus links to Amazon.com, where you can order the book directly for the Kindle.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about how you know you're too connected to all of your gadgets out there. And Peter Franklin the Gabby Cabby shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. Plus, of course, there is indeed an idiot of the day. But right now, more Stuff File news for your listening pleasure here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. It's time now for another installment of Fetishes on Parade. In March, a 19-year-old New York University student described to the New York Post her one-night experience last year as a foot fetish prostitute at a spa in which men paid a $100 entrance fee plus $20 for each 10 minutes of fondling and kissing young women's feet. She said the men wore business suits, which they kept on the whole time, and that the dressed-up women had to first pass a strict foot examination by the pimp, seeking candidates with the desired high arches and small feet. She guessed that more than 24 men patronized the spa during her shift, and that she earned $200, including tips. So, how is it that people say we're in a bad economy? Yikes. Anyway, a Western New York nun admitted she stole $128,000 to feed her gambling habit. Sister Mary Ann Rapp of the Order of St. Francis pleaded guilty in Orleans County Court to one count of fourth-degree grand larceny. Rapp stole the money from St. Mark's Church and Holly, New York, about 60 miles northeast of Buffalo. The thefts occurred from 2006 to 2011 when Rapp was placed on administrative leave because of discrepancies in church financial statements. She faces a maximum sentence of 6 months in jail and 5 years probation. Well, sounds like Sister Marianne Rapp will live up to her name, and now that she has her very own rap sheet. Although, to be forgiving is divine, and I mean, it must be difficult for a bride of Christ who has a gambling addiction. It's tough for a nun to kick the habit. Yeah, I said it. Let's move on. Target stores have taken a dress off sale after a customer complained. The dress was labeled dark heather gray in regular sizes, but manatee gray in plus sizes. Yes, manatee gray. The manatee, also known as the sea cow, can weigh nearly 2 tons. A shopper took the color's name as an insult and tweeted her displeasure on Twitter. That was retweeted enough to become a PR problem for Target. Target has apparently received no complaints about its men's t-shirts, which go up to size XXL in the manatee color, nor for towels, placemats, bath mats, and pillows in the same color. So the real mistake was labeling the smaller dresses as dark heather gray, I'm thinking. Of course, I'm sure there's somebody out there who's going to be upset about the term dark heather gray, especially someone named Heather who happens to actually be dark. Police have identified a 430-pound woman they say pretended that 2 cans of spaghetti sauce were a bomb when she robbed a Southeast Michigan bank. Police say 53-year-old Ophelia A. Neal faces bank robbery and explosives charges in the robbery at a Fifth Third Bank branch in Macomb County's Clinton Township. That's about 15 miles northeast of Detroit. Police are hunting for the parole absconder. The Michigan Department of Corrections say Neal is black, 5'7", and has partially gray hair. The statement says she has fraud, assault, and marijuana convictions. Police say the robber told bank employees she had a bomb in her cloth bag and demanded money. They say she took an undisclosed amount of money and escaped in a car with a man at the wheel. Okay, let's back up a second. They're still looking for Ophelia. I'd like to know how a black, 5'7", 430-pound woman can actually disappear. That's what I'd like to know. Okay, call it a case of the chainsaw pot ripoff. Prosecutors say a man in Washington State used a chainsaw to cut his way into a medical marijuana dispensary. An employee at Power Plant Health ran out of the back when he saw the chainsaw blade coming through the door. The dispensary owner told police he recognized the thief on security video as a former client. Police say the man took about $2,600 worth of pot in the March 23rd theft. Aren't people on pot usually more mellow than that? I mean, how stressed and angry is this guy when he's not on pot? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Crestview, Florida police were summoned to an apartment complex on a report of a man causing a disturbance. The man was wearing no clothing and yelling as he ran around and tried to get into a woman's car. When officers arrived, the man jumped on the hood of the patrol car, rolled on the grass, and tried to run off. It took 2 shots from a taser to get the man under control. What was it all about? Well, according to what the officer wrote in the arrest report, statements from the defendant were not possible, as he would only state he loved cocaine and needed more cocaine. Yeah, define need. That's what I want to know. This is your butt. This is your naked butt on drugs. Any questions? Yeah. Let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? We're living in an age where not only do most people have cell phones, they've got smartphones. We text, email, and conduct our lives on social media, both at work and at home. So, when's the last time you interacted with a real live person? Can't remember? Well, life coach Janice Bastani is the author of Eve, Reclaim Your Power, and she's here to talk about it. She joins us on the line from California. Hi, Janice.
Hello, Peter. How are you today?
Oh, just tickety-boo. So how connected are you?
I'm not very connected. I'm pretty low-tech, but I'm also connected. And what I mean by that is this. I have very clear boundaries about the use of all my eye products and my technology, and I have taught people how to interact with me where I actually have a life and interact with real people.
Is there a point when somebody should say to themselves, I might have a problem here, or is it always too late when people make that realization?
I think that when someone actually realizes that, if that puts a red flag in front of their face, here are a couple of things that you can do as a self-check to see how connected you really are and addicted you may be to your technology. One of them is, do you sleep within arm's reach of your technology at night? If that's true, then perhaps you might want to not have your technology in the same room that you sleep in. It needs to be far enough away so that you don't hear the vibration or hear the alert that goes off. That's one thing you can do. The other thing is, if your bed is your communication hub, you have a problem, a real problem. The bed is used for, you know, lovemaking and sleeping and rest and napping. It's not a place to be your own private cubicle. And again, the same kind of rules apply here. We need to have a definite place where we do those things and places where we do not do those things.
Okay, that may be, in some cases, easier said than done. And the reason why I bring that up, in the introduction, I mentioned smartphones. And one of the reasons smartphones are just that is that they do a myriad of complex things. And for some people, it's also their watch and their alarm clock, too. So not having it next to your bed could be problematic.
Sure, it could. But again, I'm talking about how you actually are relating to it and what you're using it for. I mean, I've been traveling before, and I've used it as my alarm clock, but I don't turn over first thing in the morning and turn off the alarm and immediately look at my emails. I wake up, I shower, I get dressed, and I go to breakfast. I don't immediately start my day with technology in my face.
Is it possible that the people who seem to be addicted to it the most are addicted to whatever sort of status it gives them? And the reason why I say that, I find that the more I come across people who really use these types of devices a lot, the more I realize these are the people who don't need to use these devices a lot.
That's very true. You're exactly right on that. I mean, if you've been in New York City, you will see people literally run into people and poles and, you know, newspaper and U.S. mail things because they're looking down at their phone. They're not looking where they're going. There are actually places in the United States where you can be fined for this exact thing. Another thing that I have found very interesting is we've all been in a restaurant, right? And have you ever just observed how many people are having a meal with someone and they're not communicating because they're both on their devices? I have a little trick for you if you want to try this out and just see it for yourself. And some people might consider this rude. I don't. It's like your own little litmus test. The next time you're invited for coffee or for a meal with someone and you purposely go in there and do not take the urge to pull out your device and look at it, if the person that you're with begins to and they're looking at their device, I would just say, get up and walk away from the table and see how long it takes them to notice you've even left.
Okay, so as a life coach, you come across people who have this problem. What do you say, what do you do to break them of this habit?
Well, first I want to take a measurement of where they are, and I want them to become very aware of exactly what role technology plays in their life and how much they are actually interacting with it. If they're having a problem with relationships, let's say they come to me and they're having relationship issues, one of the first things I ask them is when was the last time they actually had a for real interaction with somebody? And it might be a spouse or a lover or a friend, someone who's right in front of them, but the technology takes first priority over the relationship. That's one thing I talk about. The second thing I usually talk to them about is, you know, we teach other people how to treat us. So if we put technology above us, and or we're sitting side by side each other on the couch and we aren't talking, there's a problem there. There has to be clear boundaries when you're using it and when you're not using it. When you have a table of people sitting there, a family, and no one is talking or interacting, and they're all on their device, that's really not a healthy environment for growth at all.
Well, let me ask this question. Is it something that is generational? And I'll use this anecdote. You know, somebody says to a son or a daughter who gets a tattoo, look what you've done to yourself. You've defaced your body. Just think how silly you're going to look in an old folks home many, many years from now. To which the kid replies, well, I'll look like everyone else because everyone nowadays has tattoos. From that, using that analogy, is this, in essence, whether you like it or not, the new norm?
Well, I think in some ways it will be the norm, and I think that in 10 years, remember 10 years ago, wasn't that long ago, we didn't have widespread use of these devices, and they weren't as common as they are now, and they weren't as, they're still quite expensive, but their affordability for everybody to have them is, more affordable than it used to be. But I think in 10 years, you might see the fabric of society look entirely different, and yes, it may be the way we go, but again, I really can't stress strongly enough that you control how much that electronic device takes up the time in your life.
Assuming not everyone in your social circle is addicted to these gadgets, like so many people seem to be, would you suggest perhaps an intervention on someone who you feel is too plugged in?
I think intervention's a very strong thing, so I haven't seen that happen yet. But I do know that there are people who have, you know, literally their fabric of their life is crumbling around them because they put what's happening on the device above everything else in their life. And, you know, we basically all have about 12 life areas, and if you're putting that constant connection above everything else, the other parts of your life are beginning to fall apart. I will tell you this, Peter, I am noticing one trend that really I think is troubling to me, and that is something I call living by consensus. And what I mean by that is when somebody is trying to make a decision about anything, they ping all their friends on Facebook or Twitter to get, testing the water as to what they should do. And I think that's a dangerous place to be.
That is indeed a very dangerous place to be. We just have a couple of more minutes to chat.
Sure.
And I want to get information about your book. Your book is called Eve, Reclaim Your Power. And what exactly does that title mean?
That title is basically based on the premise that at the core of each and every one of us, we have this burning question of, am I worth it? And it is whatever it is in your life that's important to you. And over the decades that I've been doing this kind of work, what I found, male or female, it doesn't matter. The bottom line is, in order to feel worth, you have to know what you believe about the things that you're making decisions on. That's not a religious question. And we used the thing before about relationships, the example. So if you are consistently making poor decisions and relationships and they are not going anywhere, as a coach, I started asking, what is it that you believe about relationships? And that opens an entire new area of conversation. And once you know what you believe on any given topic or area of your life, Peter, you can really begin to make great decisions. You don't have to live by consensus by pinging everybody you know. And great decisions are possible, and they are possible on a consistent basis. And that's what this book is about.
So in other words, just be an individual is one way of looking at it, correct?
Well, yeah, be an individual, but you've got to know what it is you believe. Kids, even young adults and people in their 30s today, they don't have a clue what they believe about anything. They're really interested in whatever the consensus is or the testing the water in the water that they swim in. That's where they stay. And they don't have their own personal opinion and belief about something. And that is just huge. In my book, Peter, what I do is I enter into this conversation by introducing 8 very distinct female archetypes, and I walk through this process of discovery of worth through the eyes of these archetypes in different segments in time in our history. And it's a way of the reader being able to see what the archetype might say and do who has this frame of reference. And then they can align themselves and identify.
Sounds very interesting indeed. The book is called Eve, Reclaim Your Power. Janice, I thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us about people being too connected with their gadgets. People can find out more information by going to your website, which is janicebastanicoaching.com. Again, the book is Eve, Reclaim Your Power. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you so much, Peter. I've enjoyed talking to you today.
Life coach Janice Bastani, author of Eve, Reclaim Your Power. You can visit Janice's website at janicebastanicoaching.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0191, and you'll find links to Janice's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Anyone who's ever had insomnia for a long time will try just about anything to get a good night's sleep. Solutions that I've heard of range from prescription medicines to unusual home remedies, and now one of those remedies has resulted in a lawsuit against a popular doctor. Dr. Oz is a successful surgeon who has become widely known for giving advice on TV. Last year, he recommended a simple way to promote sleep. He said to put a little uncooked rice in the toes of a pair of socks, warm them in a microwave, and wear them for about 20 minutes at bedtime. He warned not to let the socks get too hot, but unfortunately, one of his viewers ignored common sense, left the socks in the microwave too long, and claims he burned his feet. Now he's suing Dr. Oz. Let's be fair, a lawsuit like this shouldn't have a leg to stand on, but in our court system, it will cost the doctor an arm and a leg, even if it's thrown out of court. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents The Gabby Cabby, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And we wing our way to New York City. Once again, the city that never sleeps and also the cabbie that never sleeps. Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, joins us once again. Hello, sir.
Hello, hello, live from the beautiful streets of New York.
Nice to have you on the program once again. Now, it's been a little while, about a week now, since the beginning of the baseball season. And something very interesting happened, I noticed, on the opening day in New York. Both the Mets and the Yankees were playing opening day, which is very odd. How is baseball season affecting New York?
Well, first of all, New York is really a baseball town because, remember, we have more than one team, as you've just indicated. Most big cities, certainly in the United States and maybe even in Canada, would love to have a baseball team, much less two. So we have an overabundance. Plus, we have 2 minor league teams. So we got 4 stadiums, not counting what people play in the parks and everything, lots of baseball. So it's a huge economic boost to the city in many, many different ways. The stadiums, the major league stadiums, let's say they have 50, 60,000 people. The baseball games in a major league is usually 160 games a season. That's 80 home, 80 away. So that means 80 days of the year, which is what we're embarking on right now, is we've got a lot of people floating around with a lot of money, not to mention, of course, the television that's going out to hundreds of millions of people. So it's a big business proposition.
Is it good for the cabs, too?
No, not really, because any cab driver that would take you to one of the stadiums is a creep. And I certainly tell most cab drivers that I come in contact, don't do it, be nice, be decent, be honest, and tell the person to take the subway. The traffic is absolutely horrendous going and coming, and the minus side to the cab driver is that once he gets the person to the stadium, if he does, he's going to be stuck in traffic trying to get away from the stadium and will be there by the time the game is ending. So it's a real mess. Take the subway and leave the driving to them.
Now, are you a Yankees fan, Mets fan, or do you still lament the loss of the Dodgers?
Well, no, I don't lament the loss of the Dodgers, but I grew up two blocks away from the Yankee Stadium. And as kids, we used to walk over to the stadium on game days. And in those days, try it today. In those days, they would let the kids of the neighborhood come in for nothing after about the fourth or fifth inning. So I really grew up surrounded by the Yankees. And we used to see people like Joe DiMaggio and, Mickey Mantle. Really walking in the streets, because remember, years and years ago, the players were much more tied to their stadiums than they are today. As a matter of fact, they even stayed at a hotel that was right next to the stadium called the Concourse Plaza Hotel. Today, these guys are flying around in their corporate jets.
Now, with all those games taking place, with all those crowds of people being around the stadiums coming and going, and with all the beer that's being served at the stadiums, it leads to one problem that I'm sure a lot of cities have, and that is people with the need or urge to want to relieve themselves.
Yeah, well, I would say in New York City, honestly, it's not a tremendous, tremendous problem. As a matter of fact, the only time I've ever seen anybody do it recently happened to be right near the Yankee Stadium. And as the guy was kind of zipping himself up, the police officer came over and started writing a ticket. And he was calm, and the cop was calm, but just at that moment, his wife came walking back from wherever she was, and you could see she was now being explained to as to what had just happened, and she was absolutely serious, because I guess she was looking at like a $130 ticket. But what came out this past week was a study, and, they probably spent millions and millions of dollars on it, because that's what politicians do, and guess what? They found out that in those neighborhoods where a lot of liquids are drunk, those are those neighborhoods in which you're more apt to have somebody pee. Now, isn't that a fantastic scientific thing, which, as I said, probably cost $100 million to figure it out?
So are there some places in New York that are more prone to peeing than others?
Yeah, those areas where they're known for more drinking of liquids, not necessarily beer or wine or liquor, but just for whatever the reason is, they were able to correlate it. And as I say, that's what I love about politicians. Only they could have spent another $200 million on such a survey, which I think is obvious to me and you, at least.
Now, do we know why they wanted this survey? I mean, are they planning to put in more public restrooms in these areas or what?
Well, let me put it this way. If I went to the city fathers and I came up with any cockamamie idea and they were willing to give me money to do it, wouldn't I do it? So, that's what I'm looking for right now. I'm looking for some funding on some projects that I want to look into. I want to see if there's any correlation between Canadians' mental health and hockey. So I'm looking to get, maybe $60, $70 million so I can do that study.
I got to tell you, Peter, my earliest memory of New York City was at the age of four. My grandmother lived in New York. She lived in Brooklyn. And we were coming in by train, and the train came in late. It came in after 11 p.m., and I needed to go to the washroom so badly. And when we got to Grand Central Terminal, the pay toilets, because that's what they had at the time, I don't know if they still have them there, the pay toilets were locked at that time of night. And my uncle said, just shimmy under the door and do what you have to do. And the idea of crawling on the floor in a public washroom in New York City to this day just gives me the chills.
Well, it couldn't happen today, and the reason it couldn't happen today is that it's against the law to charge somebody to go to the bathroom. You can refuse them, but you can't charge them. You can't say, all right, you can use the bathroom, but you have to put in a quarter or a dime or what have you, which is why we don't have any public facilities, really, because nobody is looking to get into the business of taking care of a washroom. Like, who's going to pay for it? Specifically, Grand Central Terminal is not too bad. It really is. It's in a very central location, and if people are coming to New York, it's not a bad idea to know about places like that, because when you have to do what you have to do, you'd like to know where they are. They just are in public bathrooms here. McDonald's is good, Burger King is good, that kind of thing. You're not going to be welcome in the Plaza or the Waldorf Astoria.
And just to put it in to set the chronological time, I said I was four. We're talking about 1962 here is when this took place. Anyway, on to other things. There's all this talk about gun control, but apparently who needs a gun? Do you have an interesting thing on your website about the weapons that have been used in robberies in the Big Apple?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that somebody used a teapot to hit somebody with, another person. You know, it's just, my point in this is that the right now this thing with the anti-gun thing is really flourishing. It's flourishing because, and by the way, I'm not in favor of everybody running around with a gun or anything. I think they should be very severely regulated and all of that. But this is a thing for politicians to get on the soapbox and make it seem as if they're doing something meaningful and we're against guns. You know, that's like saying we're against war. It's a very easy kind of a cop-out when it really means absolutely nothing. The guns aren't the cause of the problem. It's the insane society that we live in. In addition to that, a lot of these organizations, whether they be the NRA, who are in favor of it, or the organizations that are against it, these are wonderful income producers. Again, I mean, you can just raise money for your cause and everybody having a field day. And I'm just wondering when the people of Newtown, Connecticut are going to finally wake up to the fact that they are being so unbelievably used by the politicians and these organizations. It just boggles my mind.
Meanwhile, I understand there's a police officer who's been moonlighting in and not in a good way.
Yeah, well, this is a guy who was robbing drug dealers. I guess, you see, that's supposedly okay, because if you're robbing bad guys, that's good. I don't see that logic. And he was supplying uniforms, which are not that easy to come by, to some of his Confederates who weren't cops, and they were sticking up drug dealers. And now they've been caught, and I think the guy is kind of lucky that he's been caught by the cops. Because to get caught by the drug dealers, who I'm sure were looking for him, isn't going to help his longevity at all. Mm.
Meanwhile, I have a question for you. Have you eaten any horse meat lately?
Not that I know of, but I mean, it's an unbelievable thing that people are talking about, as if all of a sudden it's a, I hope there's no horse meat in this. Oh, I hope there's no horse meat in it. You know, it's the kind of thing nobody ever really thought about it before, and now people are thinking about it. And partly the reason that the conversation about it has been escalated is the people in Oklahoma are now going to be selling horse meat. But they were very quick to add, not in the United States, only the people outside of the United States. But that doesn't really make most New Yorkers very happy, because believe it or not, New York is a very horse town. We have the horses in Central Park. We have riding academies and riding stables. We have the cops on the horses. I mean, you know, there's a lot of horses in New York which people don't really realize. So the conversation when we heard what Oklahoma is doing, we weren't too thrilled about it. But remember, every state in the United States is far more independent than the provinces, let's say, in Canada or the counties in England. These are like 50 little countries that can do almost anything they want.
And, well, we have that same situation here, trust me. And I understand, before I let you go, you had a celebrity sighting.
Yeah, I saw Ted Danson and his wife, Mary Steenburgen. Yeah, I know. See, I can always rely on you to bail me out when I can't say a name. Yeah, I'm just walking down the street, and as I always say with my celebrity sightings, people expect me to then say something happened. No, nothing happened. I mean, you see them walking down the street. I looked at them. I'm sure they weren't aware of my existence. We didn't have a conversation. We didn't talk. We didn't go out to lunch or dinner. I just happened to see them on the street. So if anybody's interested, I just happened to see them on the street.
Oh, if only they knew the presence that they were within of Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby. Peter, people can check your website, www.gabby.com. They could also send you an email to peter@gabby.com. I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Well, thank you.
The Stuff File.
And we're almost at a racetrack on this edition of the Stuff File program. We have time for one more item, and of course, that would be the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A Louisiana man was arrested after he allegedly uploaded photographs of himself wearing stolen customized jewelry to Facebook. According to police, 26-year-old Floyd Munson is also accused of posting multiple Instagram messages and photos of himself as he taunted the owner of the jewelry, which was taken during an armed robbery last year. The unidentified victim didn't know any of the three men who kicked down his door on December the 12th. The armed robbers made off with four custom pieces of jewelry. A few days later, the victim began receiving threatening messages on Instagram. In the pictures, a man taunted the victim while wearing one of the stolen necklaces, daring him to do something about it. Just this past Wednesday, investigators executed a search warrant at Munson's apartment. There they found one of the stolen necklaces. So far, no one else has been arrested in connection with the armed robberies. Now, in this day and age of social networking and complete connectivity, why, oh why, would someone taunt a victim of theft with their own stolen items online? One reason, and one reason only, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0191. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0191. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.